This broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The English have long been known for their beautiful gardens and their passion for gardening. In a new book, design historian Andrea Wolfe explains how the English obsession began, the dedication, collaboration, and rivalries among a small group of 18th century botanists, and the remarkable contribution of one American colonial farmer. Her new book is called The Brother Gardeners. Author Andrea Wolfe joins me in the studio to talk about the history of the English love affair with plants and gardens. I do invite your calls, your comments, and questions. Please, not specifically about what to plant and where, but about the history of this wonderful relationship between the Americans and the Brits. Call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to you, Andrea. I'm so glad to see you.
Good morning.
You've written a piece for the Wall Street Journal that I was just fascinated with because the Royal Horticultural Society in Britain has people listening to tomato plants. Talk about that.
Well, on the 1st of April this year, the Royal Horticultural Society invited the public to audition for the nation's most plant-friendly voice. And I first thought, actually, it's an April
Fool's joke
because it's the 1st of April, but no, they're very serious about it. And what happens is that 45 contestants arrived and read Shakespeare, recited poetry, talked in general to the plants. Then the judges whittled down that list to 10 contestants, which are they taped the voices. And currently, as we speak, there are dozens of tomato plants in the garden listening to these voices through headphones, which are clamped to their flower pots.
And the issue is whether one voice versus another makes those plants flourish more than the
exactly.
Other.
So at the end of this trial, which will be in mid-June, they will measure the plants, and the voice which has produced the most flourishing specimen will be pronounced the voice of Wisley.
Isn't that remarkable? Well, I think there are people all over the world who believe that that relationship between plants and humans, whether it comes through the voice or whether it comes through simply thinking, caring for, tending to that plant, helps that plant to flourish. So I'm not surprised that that's going on. You began this book with your own horticultural journey. Tell us about that.
Well, so I'm from Germany, and I moved to London in the mid-1990s. And when I arrived in England, I was just amazed how many people were crazy about gardening, how everybody, young and old, seemed to think a day digging in the flower bed is the greatest entertainment. Well, none of my German friends were passionate gardeners. And so I kind of started being a little bit confused in the beginning. And, you know, so it's a tiny island. There are 4,000 private gardens open to the public. There are celebrities who became famous through their gardening TV show. So everything seemed to be kind of geared towards gardening. So I became a little bit obsessed with the British obsession with gardening. And when I got my first own garden, I kind of first ignored it, really, because I was more interested in the house.
I remember, yeah.
And then after the house was renovated, I thought, you know, I kind of looked at my garden, which looked terrible by then because the builders had kind of like trampled everything dead. So I started, but I didn't really know anything. So I, you know, when visitors came, I asked them, what kind of flower is this? What plant is this? And slowly over the years, I learned that there's a lot of history behind these plants. And actually, very few of those plants in the English garden are actually native species. They came from the expanding empire. So slowly I became more and more interested in this and set out really to understand the British obsession. And through that, I think I wanted to understand the British.
And the people behind how that gardening became so important to the Brits. You write about a man named Philip Miller, who published a book called Gardener's Dictionary in 1731. Talk about him.
Well, he was the head gardener of the Chelsea Physic Garden, which in London, which was a very important botanic collection. But what was really remarkable is this book, because it is a plant dictionary. What he did is that he listed every plant that was in cultivation in Britain alphabetically, and under each entry he would give information how to nurture and propagate this plant. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting and revolutionary to us, but in the early 18th century it was extraordinary because other contemporary horticultural publications were still repeating plant lore and superstition. So they would, for example, advise that you could turn your lemons red by grafting them onto mulberry trees, for example. So what Philip Miller did is he based everything on scientific observation and his experiments.
What did British gardens look like before that book was published in 1731?
So the English garden in the late 17th century and early 18th century was a garden very much ruled by geometry and straight lines. So you would have straight avenues, you would have topiary, you would have hedges which were literally kind of cut into green walls. These were gardens where nothing was allowed to grow unruly. And there were gardens which looked nice about 5 months a year, but the rest of the year, so for example, in winter, they would look pretty boring. The British have only 4 native evergreen species, for example. So the English gardeners were very keen to get plants into the country which would look good at other times of the year.
Plants that would look good at other times of the year, and where were they looking for those plants?
So there's one man who's called Peter Collinson. He was a London cloth merchant, incredibly passionate about plants, and he was a friend of Benjamin Franklin. He had met Franklin when Franklin had come to London in the 1720s, and he was sending books to the library company in Philadelphia for Franklin. And he was kind of telling him about his passion for plants. And through that connection, Franklin introduced him to an American farmer called John Bartram, who lived in Philadelphia, just outside Philadelphia on his farm. And in 1734, Peter Collinson picked up 2 wooden boxes in London, which John Bartram had sent. And in these boxes, there were seeds from the North American
what
colonies.
What kinds of seeds?
Mainly trees and shrubs, because the English gardeners didn't want plants for their greenhouses. They really wanted to have plants for their garden, for their outside space. So these two boxes were really the first of many, many hundreds which would cross the ocean over the next 40 years. And I think that the relationship between Collinson and Bartram was the most important horticultural friendship really in the 18th century and would change the English garden completely.
And of course there was no quarantine imposed on those living seeds at the time.
No, not at all. But you have to bear in mind that many of them didn't survive the long sea journey. So imagine you have a few shrubs planted in barrels, for example, on the deck on a ship, which crosses climate zones. There's the salty water, the wind. So the success rate was not very good. Sometimes Collinson knew the captain of the ship and would ask him a favor. So the captain would put some of the seed boxes under his bed where they were kept warm and safe.
But, you know, it's interesting. You write that John Bartram sent over Wisteria. He sent over White Cypress. He sent over Euonymus and Witch Hazel. Now, none of those plants then had ever been grown in England.
Most of these were introduced by Bartram. Some of them actually, so for example, he also sent the tulip poplar, which had been introduced in the 17th century, but there were only, I mean, literally a couple of specimens in botanic collections. What John Bartram did was he literally showered seeds, cones, and acorns onto the English landscape. It was the sheer quantities, because he was sending hundreds of these boxes across the ocean. So suddenly the English gardeners had this vast choice of specimens, of species they had never seen before.
And, of course, John Bartram was simply an American farmer.
Yes, he was an American farmer, very much a self-educated man, who I think is utterly charming and lovely. And when you read his letters, he's so passionate about what he sees. When he goes plant hunting, so every autumn he would go plant hunting for his English customers, and he would describe his journeys to Peter Collinson so that Peter Collinson could follow him from the comfort of his armchair, really, in London. And these descriptions of the American wilderness are just extraordinary, because he gets so excited. He gets so excited that he doesn't notice if there's a storm, for example. He gets stranded on a mountain because he forgets that, you know, he has to turn around and it all gets dark. So because he never loses that passion.
Andrea Wolf, her new book is titled The Brother Gardeners, A Botany Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. We'll take a short break and be right back. And just before the break, I was talking with Andrea Wolf about her new book, The Brother Gardeners, and most especially John Bartram, who happens to be a direct ancestor of my husband. My husband is named John Bartram Rehm. His mother was Mary Bartram Torr. They lived in Philadelphia, and I have yet to see the John Bartram Gardens. You must have been there many times.
Yes, I absolutely love it. It's a very special, it's like a little oasis, really. And you absolutely enter into the 18th century when you enter into the garden. So you really, you've got to take
We've
your husband
got to
and
go.
You've got to go. Yes.
Absolutely. Tell us what John Bartram was like, the kind of life he lived, his family, how he made a living.
So John Bartram was a Quaker, and he was a farmer, and he's sometimes portrayed as this really humble farmer, which he wasn't. If you see his house, it's a kind of relatively big stone house, which he built over the years. So he was not, and he was connected to quite a lot of the kind of scientific elite in Philadelphia. That's how he knew Benjamin Franklin. He actually co-founded the American Philosophical Society with Benjamin Franklin. But he couldn't really afford going plant hunting before he was introduced to Peter Collinson. So he had to mainly do his farming.
So he was paid for the seeds he sent abroad.
Yes. So Collinson organized the subscription system for the so-called 5-guinea boxes. So for 5 guineas a year, the English gardeners could get a big wooden box which was filled with 105 different species of seeds. So it became almost a little bit of a standardized mail order business, which allowed Bartram to go plant hunting every year, leaving his farm in the very capable hands of his wife. So without his wife, he would have not been able to actually do that, because he would be sometimes gone for 6 weeks. So she would be dealing with the day-to-day of the farm.
And where would he find these various species?
So he started off in Pennsylvania. And then once he'd sent most of the species from Pennsylvania, Collinson started to complain and say, like, well, what about, you know, the other colonies? So he went further and further. He went to Virginia. He went further up north. And then he went all the way south to Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina. In particular, in the 1760s, the English gardeners suddenly realized that the southern colonies would provide all the flowering shrubs. Mm. So Magnolia grandiflora, for example, southern catalpa. And they were incredibly keen to get these flowering trees and shrubs.
There is another key figure in the development of English gardens, and that's Carl Linnaeus. Who was he?
Carl Linnaeus was a Swedish botanist who was, let's say, relatively arrogant. And he called himself rather modestly the Prince of Botanists. So he was, you know, he was sure that he was good. He was good. He was a very obsessive cataloger. And he kind of changed the way the 18th century classified plants. But he also introduced an international naming system, because until he invented this new naming system, plants which would arrive, for example, from America could receive a different name, say, in Paris, in London, and in Edinburgh. And gardeners would get very upset because they pay a lot of money for these seeds. They would nurture them for 3 years, and then they suddenly realize, I have this plant already. So what Carl Linnaeus did is he gave every plant a two-word name, which is still what we do today. So, for example, which is almost like a first name and a surname.
But didn't he also develop this classification system that actually classified plants by counting their sexual parts?
Yes. It was called the sexual system, and he introduced that. And what he did is he divided the world of flowering plants into 23 classes according to the number of the male organs, the stamens, which he called husbands. And he then subdivided this by the number of the female organs, the pistils, which he called wives. It didn't help that he called the flower head the bridal bed. So the English botanists were rather shocked by the indecency of the sexual system. And one botanist actually said that it's too smutty for British ears. So they were not too keen on it. The Americans actually accepted it fairly quickly because it was very simple, because you only had to count, really, to be able to master it.
But he was the one then who finally developed the naming system so that there was consistency.
Exactly. So Bartram could send, say, a Magnolia grandiflora, and his customers in England would know what it is. So, and we use them today. So I can, for example, I can go to a plant nursery in Germany where my parents live and buy the same plant as I can buy here or in London. And that's thanks to Linnaeus, which actually, if you think of the common names, which are completely different. When we did the US edition of this book, I had to change quite a few of the common names because they're different to the common names in England.
All right. We have many callers. I want to go to the phones and take as many as we can. 800-433-8850. First to Princeton, New Jersey. Good morning, Roberta. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Good morning.
Hi.
I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
I called because I had a chance about 6 years ago to visit Bartram's Gardens in Pennsylvania.
Good.
And he was a fascinating botanist. But one of the reasons I wanted to go was he had propagated a tree that he had found in the South, I think it was Georgia, which he called a Frankliniana, after Benjamin Franklin. And it was a tree similar to a dogwood, but it bears its blossoms in the fall. And as I arrived there, I saw there was a spring sale going on, so I raced over to it and bought the very last one.
Ah.
And it's still flowering.
Oh, how marvelous. And it is a white or a pink dogwood?
White. It's not a dogwood.
It's not a dogwood. It simply looks like a dogwood.
Very similar, yes. But it blooms in the fall. And I gave it a very sheltered spot here, of course, because we're not quite the same climate as Georgia.
Yeah. You know that tree very well, I gather.
Well, I have to say, you are very lucky that you can grow it in your garden, because I'd never seen it flowering. It was only last September that when I came to Philadelphia, that I actually saw it. And it's a wonderful tree because...
It is. It's a beautiful tree, even when it's not flowering.
Huh.
Yeah, and also because in the autumn, you get the red leaves, and sometimes there are still some of the white flowers kind of clinging on. So you have the flowers and the... autumn leaves.
Yes.
Well, I envy you, Roberta. I hope to make that journey someday myself. Thanks so much for calling. To Ashland, Kentucky, and to Stephen, you're on the air.
Hey, Diane, I listen to you every day. Thanks for having me on. Thank you. And I was just going to say, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Malawi, Africa for several years, and my nearest neighbor was a lady from Wales, and she taught me basically everything I know about permaculture and just turned me on to so many things of budding and grafting fruit trees and a lot of things. Being from Kentucky, I wasn't very familiar with.
How wonderful.
What?
Also, her neighbor was a GTZ, the German fellow, and she's right. They have not much interest at all in gardening, I have to say.
Andrea, do you want to comment?
Well, they are obviously, so let's not offend the Germans too much. There are obviously some very good gardeners in Germany, but I think you are right. The English do have a passion for it, and they have this extraordinary thing that when they go abroad, they kind of take this love with them. For example, in India, there were lots of, during the colonial time, there were lots of English women who tried to grow roses because they were trying to kind of bring a little bit of England with them into the foreign country.
Interesting. Thanks for calling, Stephen. Here's an email from Ron in Ohio, who says, I read lots of historical fiction. I especially like the stories of high sea adventure. In many of those stories, British ships often had gardens on board or were bringing live plants back from excursions around the world. Is this just fiction, or did plants really have gardens?
No, this is absolutely true. So, for example, when the British sent the first fleet to Australia to create the penal colony there in 1787, Joseph Banks, who's one of my characters in my book, he equips the boat with a greenhouse, because what they want to do is they want to send plants to the new colony, because plants, vegetables, fruits, incredibly important in order to feed the new colonists. So, yes, there were greenhouses put onto boats, and there was even if you've heard of the mutiny on the Bounty, the Bounty was actually one big floating garden, because it was sent out to transport breadfruit trees from the East Indies to the West Indies. The great cabin was turned into a big greenhouse. The only cargo on the boat was the water, which they needed to water the plants.
Well, how was there room for the crew and all the people who needed to take care of those plants?
Well, the captain had to move out of his great cabin, and he got a very, very small cabin next to it. So the plants were the most important thing on the ship.
Well, and because they were so valuable, I gather, then, not only for monetary reasons, but because they created sustainability. All right, let's go now to Anita in Howard City, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. This is so interesting.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
I'm just taking it all in. I know no matter how long a person lives, there is not everything you can know about gardening.
Hardly.
I have a very favorite plant, a gardenia, and I wonder if your guest knows a little bit about its history, where it came from.
The gardenia, unfortunately, is not one of the plants that you have talked about in this book, is it, Andrea?
It kind of pops up very briefly. The only thing I can tell you about the gardenia is that there was a big controversy about the naming of the gardenia because Philip Miller in London thought it was a part of the jasmine genus. And
they smell the same.
Yes.
Quite similar.
And Linnaeus decided it was a separate genus, so it needed a name. And the man who had first grown it in Britain was someone called, I think, Wagner. And so Linnaeus wanted to name the plant after him. But Wagner was a very good friend of Miller and thought, I can't really do that because Miller is going to be really upset because Miller is saying that this is actually a jasmine. So there was a little bit of a hoo-ha going on. And then in the end, they named it after Alexander Garden, who was a physician and plant collector in Charleston.
I hope that helps, Anita. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Vincenttown, New Jersey. Hi there, Brad. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you for taking the question.
Sure.
It seemed I am from the area, and it seems to me that I saw some years ago at the Academy of Natural Sciences a minute book from the Lansdowne meeting where John Bartram was disowned from meeting and questioning the divinity of Christ. So I have two questions for you. One is, these lush gardens, was there any comment about not being within the Quaker testimony of simplicity? And was he influenced by the deists in Philadelphia with his thinking? How did a simple farmer, you know, come to that if indeed it is true?
Andrea.
Well, this is a difficult question. I've never quite worked out why he was actually excluded. The only way I can explain that is that John Bartram was no one who was, how shall I explain it? So, for example, he got very upset when the Quakers in Pennsylvania decided not to fight in the war in the 1740s. So he was not 100% really agreeing with everything they were doing. I think the great estates and the simplicity, that wasn't actually so much of a problem because, for example, Peter Collinson is also a Quaker and he has a quite grand garden and he's actually advising quite a lot of aristocratic gardeners on their garden. Actually, I think there's a very high proportion of Quakers within the botanical world because flowers were actually one of the few things which were allowed to, you know, not just be simple because they were a sign of God's creation.
Help me to understand what our caller meant and you mean by the term excluded.
He was basically thrown out of his church, out of his meeting. He was not allowed to be part there anymore.
And that would have been for reasons you're unclear about.
Yeah, I don't know why that was.
You don't know why that was. Okay, I'll bet.
One of our
callers will call in to tell us why John Bartram was excluded from his meeting. There is so much in this book about the writing, the naming, the classification there, and the relationship between you call them the brother gardeners, was there a certain amount of competition among them as well?
Certainly. I think it's still, every gardener is a little bit competitive. I would, guess that is true for most people. They are incredibly generous in sharing their plants. The brother gardeners always shared their plants, but then once they had them, there was a race going on. Who was going to bring this plant to blossom first? If you look at just Peter Collinson and John Bartram, for example, they were, at the beginning of their relationship, very much unequal. Peter Collinson felt superior to Bartram because he was an educated, wealthy cloth merchant. Bartram was just a farmer. Over the 40 years of their relationship, they became incredibly close and equal. And this was done through the plants. And I think this is what I find so incredible about this, that they just, their love for the plants, that's what that kind of transcends social class and religion.
Andrea Wolf, and the book is titled The Brother Gardeners. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Nothing lasts forever. John Mellencamp has just released a new album featuring live versions of many of the songs from his recent release, Life, Death, Love, and Freedom. And he's on tour with Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan. On the next Fresh Air, John Mellencamp performs some old and new songs. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
So you pretend not to notice.
Here's an email from Pat in Carmel, Indiana, who says, I'm listening to your wonderful show on gardening, and while listening and the study on the best plant voice was discussed, it made me wonder if the fact that anything green takes carbon monoxide out of the environment, that maybe it's partly the carbon dioxide that you breathe on them while talking to them. So I went around and breathed deeply on each of my houseplants. She says, we'll see. Now, here's another from David, who says, I'm listening to the show while harvesting, preparing pollen for controlled apple breeding. Was there any breeding work being done with the material during the great era of collecting that the show is discussing?
Well, it's funny that this question comes because the book starts with a prologue, which is called The Fairchild Mule, which is about the first man-made hybrid, which was produced in 1716 by a man called Thomas Fairchild, who was a London nurseryman. And he goes into his potting shed with a carnation and a sweet William and creates the first hybrid. And then
let's picture this again, a carnation and sweet William, and two such totally different looking flowers. And he cross-pollinates. And what happens?
So when the flower actually grows the next year, he is delighted because it looks completely different. But he also panics at the same time because he suddenly realizes that he's been interfering in God's creation. So when he goes to the Royal Society, who have heard about the
What he's done.
They want to hear about it. He panics and he says, this was an accidental hybrid. By coincidence, the two flower heads just somehow touched each other in the flower bed. And he also left a legacy to his parish church for an annual sermon about God's creation, which, funnily enough, in Britain is still going on.
Really?
It's called the Vegetable Sermon.
The vegetable sermon,
yes.
But there is all kinds of interbreeding going on within plant culture, is there not?
Well, at the beginning of the 18th century, botanists were just getting their head around the idea that plants were reproducing sexually. So Thomas Fairchild is fairly early to do this. Then 20 years later, we have John Bartram, who very happily creates hybrids in his garden. So they move fairly quickly. And then in the beginning of the 19th century, you have huge hybridization and breeding programs.
Perhaps with God's blessing.
Probably.
Here's an email from John, who says, across the street from my office building is a commemorative marker on a stone for John Bartram's journey across the Southeast in the 18th century in Franklin, North Carolina. In the Macon County News, dated 4-23-09, there is a front page picture, an article of the North Carolina Bartram Trail Society and their work for Earth Day. His legacy lives on. That's great. All right, let's go back to the phones and to, let's see, Bob in Eaton, Ohio. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call, Diane.
Sure.
I have a question about my wife and I. Just we're first time home buyers, bought our house recently, and we are of course interested in making our yard and landscaping very pretty. And my question for your guest is I'm curious about the conservation movement in gardening regarding native species and non-invasives. How does that look? English versus American, and does she have any, how picky should I be?
Interesting question, Andrea.
Well, I think, I'm not a practical gardener, so I'm not going to give you any advice what you're going to,
and
put
what
in
you
your
want
garden.
To plant your garden.
I can only give you a look back to history and say that John Bartram is, I think, the first American gardener who really appreciates Native American species, because until then, American gardeners really wanted to have European plants. And he's the first he grows them in his garden to send them to England. But over time, he gets more and more customers from within America. And you have, for example, 50 years after he sends his first boxes to England, you actually have people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson going to Bartram's nursery and buying native species for their American gardens.
So interesting. All right, Bob, I hope that helps a bit. Let's go now to Key West, Florida. Vanessa, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you. What an absolutely fascinating discussion. Congratulations on this marvelous book. I shall get it.
Good.
I have a nephew. He's quite young. He's in his late 20s. He is an arborist at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh. And when I was in England a couple of years ago, he took me around. We were staying on a farm in Dorset, and he was identifying all these trees, and I was absolutely fascinated at his knowledge, and it was so lovely that a young person would have this fantastic interest and carry on this marvelous study. And he was the one who told me about a seed bank. And that is being kept with all the seeds in the world. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
This seed bank?
It's the seed bank. It's called Wakehurst. It's the seed bank in Wakehurst, which is part actually of the Royal Botanic Garden in Kew. So what they are doing is they are trying to collect as many plants as possible. I think by now they have collected either 10, 15 or 20% of all the species, known species across the world, and they want to collect in the next decade another 20%.
Oh, wow. And what about, is there one also in Norway or something like that that is supposed to survive catastrophes and that sort of thing? Something global crop?
Yes.
Diversity or something like that?
Exactly. So there's one in Norway in a cave, but they are collecting only useful plants. So that's kind of agricultural
seeds.
What does
that mean?
Agricultural seeds, so crops. So if,
I see.
You know, fruit trees, crops, vegetables. While the Millennium Seed Bank in Wakehurst, they go, you know, they collect
everything.
Plants. Everything.
Yeah. Everything. Well, Vanessa, you've got some fascinating research to do. Thanks for calling.
It's my pleasure.
Let's go to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Seth.
Hi, good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I've got a sort of two-part question about hedges. I just recently visited the UK, and I loved seeing all the hedges everywhere instead of fences and chain-link fences. And I just wonder why there are not more hedges in the United States, and do the same species of hedges that grow in the UK grow in the U.S.?
Well, the hedges is an interesting question, because the founding fathers, Washington, Franklin, and Jefferson, were desperately trying to grow hedges, because they realized, because they had seen them in England and had exactly the same experience as you had, and were wondering, why is this not happening here? Because what you have to bear in mind is, in the beginning, there was just so much forest in America. So the idea was just to clear the forest, and there was so much timber, so they used fences because that was easier, that was quicker. And then the later generation tried to grow fences, tried to grow hedges. And Jefferson, for example, when he retires from his presidencies, he brings, I think, 3 cartloads of Washington thorn home to Monticello to try to grow hedges there.
And?
They never quite worked. I don't know why, but they never quite worked. They
soil, perhaps, different types. Who knows?
Who knows?
Interesting. To Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Homer. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane. I just wanted to encourage you, as you indicated earlier in the show, to go to the Bartram Gardens in Philadelphia. I was born and raised in Philadelphia, and it wasn't until I was 40 years old that I got there. And it's a gem of a garden and a wonderful place to be. The Stone Farmhouse is there, and they also have some reenactors who are doing some of the gardening that Bartram did, and just again want to encourage you to go see Bartram Garden.
You know, Homer, before the show this morning, I sent our son an email telling him I was going to do this book because, of course, he is named David Bartram Ream, and I said to him, we must go to see those gardens. Now, let me ask you a question. A caller is asking where the Bartram Garden was in relation to the core of the city of Philadelphia. Do you know the answer to that, Homer?
Yes, I do. The Bartram Gardens are in the southeast section of the city. So if you go south of downtown and go just east a little bit, it's right on the border of the Delaware River.
Interesting. Andrea?
I mean, I'm always very bad with my geography. I always thought it's to the west, but maybe you're right. You're from Philadelphia, and it's at the, and I can never pronounce the name of the river, Schuylkill River? I'd never know.
Schuylkill River.
Exactly. It's at the banks of that river, actually. I think.
Right, yes. I'm correct. Yes, it's on the bank to the Schuylkill River.
All right, Homer, I promise I'll do as you say. I'll get up there and see that garden.
Okay.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome.
And to John in Northern California, how are you this morning? John, are you there? Perhaps not. Let's go to Collinsville, Alabama. Good morning, Stephen.
Yes, it's a fascinating discussion. Just wanted to mention that Ron Rash, a novelist in Western North Carolina, I saw we got an email from Franklin. He mentions John Bartram in his novel One Foot in Eden, and there's a flower in the novel that references Bartram's work in upstate South Carolina in Oconee County, and it's very fascinating because this novel is kind of an elemental novel of sexual desire, but the fact that as I just learned this morning, that Bartram's plant life was, had an emphasis on the sexuality of plants kind of, for me, opens up a new layer of understanding of this novel. Rash, by the way, was nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award this year for his novel Serena, a later novel, which is about, in one way, the timber industry in Western North Carolina in the 1930s. So this is just all fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating show. And, just listening about Bartram, very fascinating. Thank you very much.
Stephen, thank you so much for that call and for that tidbit. Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Janet. At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Go right ahead, Janet.
Well, good morning, and thank you. I got very excited when you mentioned the Ben Franklin tree. I just planted two of them last year. I have not had a chance to see them bloom yet. But I got them from a plant catalog in North Carolina, and the explanation under the listing for that plant was that they... whole name is Alatamaha Franklinia, and it grew along the Alatamaha River outside of Philadelphia, and was not seen in the wild since the 1770s when the land was cleared there for farming. Evidently, it was a very specific species and has not been seen in the wild. It's existed only in gardens ever since.
You are right with this, but the river is actually in Georgia. That's where they found them. And apparently, or reputedly, all the Franklinias you can buy now come from the specimens which the Bartrams, John Bartram and his son William Bartram, had collected.
Wow.
So you might have actually, the tree you bought might have actually, has the same DNA.
So his son, William, carried on.
Yeah, so John took his son William on his later journeys when he got a bit older because he needed someone to climb up the trees, basically. And then when he died in 1777, his son, another John, took over the nursery, and the other son, William, went traveling. And he wrote a very famous book about his travels through the South. And then when he came back, he started also helping his brother. So both brothers continue to run the nursery.
Last call from Jacksonville, Florida. Quickly, Ed, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Wanted just to touch base, and you were talking about William Bartram and his travels to the South. It's interesting here in northeast Florida, particularly in St. Johns County near the St. Augustine area, that the Bartram Trail is still preserved as a historic trail and pathway. And quite a number of developments in that area are named after the Bartram family. There's a really large involvement of the Bartram name in this area.
Yeah, you can still, I mean, there's the Bartram Trail still. You can still walk quite a lot of the parts that William Bartram traveled along. What I'm amazed about is that how many people in the South actually know of him. And a lot of people in Philadelphia have never heard of John Bartram.
Really?
Yeah.
Have never heard of John Bartram when the gardens are right there.
Yep. Well, you have never been to them.
I have never been to them, but I have the inside scoop. What can I say? Well, I must say this has been a fascinating conversation, especially to know about this early, early relationship between the Americans and the British in the development of these gorgeous British gardens. But I would still maintain that in the spring, there is no more beautiful city than Washington, D.C. It truly, truly is, with the combination of azaleas, dogwoods, jonquils, tulips, everything. Just takes my breath away, as does your book, Andrea Wolf. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And the book is titled The Brother Gardeners, Botany, Empire, and the Birth of an Obsession. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.